This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we talk with Mark Baker, the President and CEO of AOPA, the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association. Also, wake turbulence from an A380 flips a Challenger 604. Two flight attendants sue American Airlines for failure to enforce company policy. One engine on a Saab 340 loses its propeller in flight, an interview from the National Air and Space Museum Restoration Center, and an idea for a circular runway. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 444 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. Joining me first is Rob Mark. He's senior editor at Flying Magazine. He's a CFI and publisher of the Jetwine blog. Hi, Rob.
Hi. I remember me? I'm the guy that hasn't been here the last couple of weeks, so I apologize for that. I was off gallivanting around the helicopter show last week, and... You know how it is when you get around helicopters. I just kind of go vertical.
And you ran into Launchpad Marzari.
I did, actually. And we'll tell you a couple of funny stories, although I'm sure he's already preceded me with those.
Okay. All right. Also co-hosting is the other Max, Max Trescott. He's also a certified flight instructor. He's an author and a glass cockpit expert. Max, how are you?
Hello, Max East and Rob and listeners around the world. I ran across an email here just a day or two ago, and it reminded me that I joined you guys almost 3 years ago. Can you believe that?
Is that right? Boy, it feels a lot longer, I tell you.
That's right.
No, actually, I was going to mention that it's time for your performance review. And I think we might as well do it tonight. Well, no, that wouldn't be fair to our guests. We'll wait till later.
All right.
Yeah, we'll save the lashings for later. That'd be great.
All right. Well, our guest this episode is Mark Baker, President and CEO of the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association. Now, Mark, of course, is a longtime GA pilot. He's been flying for, oh, I don't know, maybe around 35 years or so, has over 7,500 hours. Mark's the fifth president in the 75-year history of AOPA. He started that role in 2013. Now, Mark is also chairman of AOPA's Political Action Committee. He's chief executive officer for the AOPA Foundation, president of the International Council of Aircraft Owners and Pilots Associations. We learned about that last episode. And he's publisher of AOPA Pilot, which is the world's largest aviation publication. So, Mark, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Hey, it's great to be here with you guys tonight. Max Squared, and I really appreciate the opportunity to tell our story.
Now, we understand that, of course, you've flown a really impressive array of aircraft over the years, including pistons and jets, helicopters, even historic aircraft. But I understand that your favorite remains the Piper Super Cub that you've owned for many years. Is that right?
It is. I've owned a lot of different airplanes and had the opportunity to fly a lot of interesting airplanes, World War II or previous, and including I got my DC-3 Typewriter, you know, a couple years ago. But I tell you, getting in the Super Cub and, you know, going for a ride looking down is a most special thing that I do. I've taken it to Hudson Bay, to Mexico, to Key West, and this year I plan to make Alaska with my Super Cub.
Wow. Now, is it true that you've put skis and floats on that airplane?
Yeah, I bought it from the original owner. It was in 1953 and had 300 total time when I bought it. It had straight floats, straight skis. I since upgraded to amphibious floats and retractable wheel skis and big tires. And depending on the season, it's ready to go.
Yeah, all right. You're prepared. Very good. All right. Well, this episode, we're going to get right into our conversation with Mark. So is everybody ready?
Yeah. Ready from the West.
All Mark, I'm not an aircraft owner or a pilot, but years ago, B'nai Wilson informed me that those weren't requirements for membership, and she told me about the role AOPA plays advocating for aviation. So I've been a member ever since. Let's talk a little bit about the advocacy areas that AOPA feels are key today. What would you say those are, Mark?
Well, first, thanks for being in membership. You know, we do have a lot of enthusiasts that stay in touch through AOPA about the things that excites them about aviation. And since 1939, AOPA has been about advocating for safety among us pilots and owners, as well as it has been about the fun in flying, and then making sure we continue to protect what we call the freedom to fly. And, you know, the fifth person to take on this role in 78 years now, I want to protect the opportunity to have access to the sky, which is uniquely Americana, without user fees, access to nearly 5,000 public airports and over 12,000 now private airstrips, let alone all the lakes and rivers that can be landed on with the right equipment. It is an Americana dream to be able to go take a small airplane and putter along at 70, 80, 90 miles an hour and go across this great country with unfettered access. And, you know, we have, as an association, have protected that with our hundreds and hundreds of thousands of members. And if you compare that to any place else in the world, it's truly a unique experience. On top of nearly all the general aviation airplanes in the world were built here in the U.S.
Certainly ATC privatization is a big issue. Well, it has been for some time now. And we see in the budget proposal from President Trump that he seems to be on the side of privatizing ATC. What's AOPA stand on this? Where do you think this is going to go, Mark?
Well, I think it'll be another interesting year, as has been proposed on and off for 20 or 30 years to privatize air traffic control. And our view is that, you know, with the largest general aviation population, you know, here, we rarely, if never, receive a complaint about how well our controllers, the whole tower system works. So when we think about things that need fixing, we don't tend to focus on ATC. It's worked pretty well for general aviation. What we do focus on is an issue that we've been compelled to bring up over and over and over, and have so far always won the battle, what's called user fees. Many parts of the rest of the world, probably 50 or 60 countries that have privatized their air traffic control, have also gone to a user fee system, which we think can lead to safety issues. Certainly, if they charge more for an instrument flight versus a VFR flight, people making decisions based on economics rather than just safety alone. And so we have been very strongly compelled to say no user fees on any part of general aviation, period. You can't have the next conversation about how could we run this FAA, which works pretty well, particularly the ATC thing, which works, I think, very well. And what are the real problems we're trying to fix as it relates to general and business aviation? It doesn't rise to the top. Now, we're always interested as taxpaying citizens to say if there's something that we could do to save money as a taxpayer, run things more efficiently or more expeditiously in terms of procurement, we should talk about those things. So without just saying no, never on privatization, let's talk about what could we fix. But never, no way, no how, have a user fee invoked in general aviation.
Now, when you say that AOPA has spoken out against user fees in that context, for our listeners who may not be completely aware, can you just maybe briefly describe the forums where you're able to express that desire?
Yeah, I've had numerous testimonies in the last couple of years with the House and the Senate about that issue and say we're never going to support user fees. We have a very efficient thing called a fuel tax, where the government gets the money while it's being refined before it's even shipped. And I don't know if there's 5 or 10 people in the whole government that's involved in collecting that fee or tax, but it's very efficient. And we think that is, in one sense, you know, those that fly the most pay the most in terms of the fuel tax that's there. Why would you have another bureaucracy created that'd be about weight and distance, which many of the other air traffic control systems around the rest of the world do, and add that extra layer when we have a very efficient system? So user fees in the rest of the world have been everything, even in Canada, where you pay by an access route, then you pay again when you get to the airport, and it's a ramp fee after that. So it inhibits the free movement of general aviation instead of just employing a fuel tax, which I think is very efficient.
Max T, we ran a survey with our listeners concerning privatization of air traffic control, and you have some results from that maybe you can share with us?
I do. This came up back in February when there was a survey that had been released. It was a survey of, a phone survey of just American citizens. And we thought, well, why not survey our listeners, who are mostly pilots, to see what they think about this. And we've also got a reasonably large international audience, so we thought we'd get some inputs from them and see what they thought. And Mark, you're absolutely right. Everybody agrees that FAA is doing a good job, and they even rate ATC as being even better than they rate the FAA. So, of all the things the FAA is doing, the ATC gets really, really high marks from our listeners. So the general ratings on the FAA, good and excellent. Good was 65%, excellent 25%. When you talk about ATC, good was 42% and excellent was 52%. So 94% of the people think they're doing a good or excellent job with ATC. We then asked folks about whether or not they strongly support or oppose privatization in general. And only about, 26% either somewhat or somewhat strongly supported privatization in general. Those numbers dropped down when we asked them about ATC to 8%. And total strongly oppose ATC privatization by 81%, 6% somewhat oppose it. So we're hearing a really large cry from pilots saying, no, we're not interested in this. And I guess EAA and NBAA and HAI have all recently come out opposed to that. I'm kind of curious if the bill is written so that user fees can't be imposed. Once this new corporation is off on its own and presumably doesn't have any congressional oversight, what's to prevent them from implementing fees at some point in the future?
Well, I think the structure I've heard about, which I have not ever seen officially because I never left anything other than committee last year, as you know, was that all of the fees on general aviation would be remanded at a congressional level. The board and the private-public institution would have no taxing or fee authority over general aviation, period. Now, the devil's always in the details. Do I trust that in terms of could it be revoked at some later date? It's something I've been very uncomfortable with. But that's the way that I believe it is structured at the moment. But we keep continuing to ask the question, what are we really trying to fix? I mean, if ATC is working pretty well for general aviation, what's not working for the airlines or the Defense Department? And I sit on what's called the Next Gen Advisory Committee, which has been chaired for the last, 8 or 10 years by an individual chairman from one of the airlines, Alaska, more recently Delta, now FedEx is a chair. And they set the priorities which the FAA responds to in terms of the rollout of the next levels of any innovations, and whether it's PBM and rivals or eventually Datacom, which I think would be huge. I see it still working. That's what I'm kind of a little bit confused with. Now, on the other hand, if I'm an open-minded listener, and I think we all should be at this point in time, is to say, is the government the best and the most expeditious and the most efficient at either reducing the number of centers and giving them better equipment? Do they latch on to new technologies faster than or as fast as they should? I think government sometimes is not necessarily the fastest and most efficient. And we want to figure out what could we do better without necessarily pushing it all the way to a private enterprise that's just there to make money, which we won't support.
Hmm. One thing I was going to say too, though, Mark, is that when you mentioned the devil's in the details, that's something that I have been following for a long time. I spent 10 years of my life as a controller back in another life, but I'm still trying to understand where the details are, because what we hear, and we've heard this on almost every one of these privatization moves, we hear bits and pieces of things that people say they think they heard are going to be in there, but we never really seem to get a great many facts, as in who's going to run the board that is going to run this organization? Well, it's going to be mostly the airlines. Actually, no, the airlines aren't going to have that big a say. It'll be spread around amongst everybody, so it's fair. And okay, just show me that in writing somewhere. on any of these details, and we never see that, do we?
No, I think that's very fair. And, you know, the controllers have come out, I think, generally in favor of this, which is kind of interesting. But what we've kind of held our powder dry for, and I've spoken to the new chairman, Chao, of the Secretary of Transportation, you know, we want to be open-minded. If there's something that we should do better, we don't want to be an obstacle. On the other hand, I don't trust anything until I've seen the details. And who are you trying to support? What are you trying to change? And, you know, what are the risks and rewards? And that has not been forthcoming at this point in time. I think it's smart for many of us to say, okay, show me those details, and then we can make a real informed decision for or against, or not this, but maybe that. And I think that's important to have a dialogue, and I hope that's part of what we believe in our government, that we have to have a dialogue and buy into the framing before we just automatically either say yes or no.
I was watching the live hearings last year when they were talking about the bill, and at one point it came out that apparently AOPA might be able to name one of the people who's going to be on the board of approximately, you know, 15 people. What can you tell us about that, and would GA really be able to, you know, fight something that the airlines decide they want to do?
Well, that's a really important detail. I don't even call that a devil in details. That's an important detail that we think general aviation and business aviation has to be represented completely on this board and not be overwhelmed by a consortium of different views that might be commercially oriented only. So there's got to be a fairness in principle about either blocking votes or, you know, something that requires a supermajority. And those are the kind of details that really do matter to us. But again, I constantly go back to saying, what are we trying to solve? Who does it benefit? Who is at risk? And does it save money? Does it make our efficient system more efficient? And until those answers become more visible, well, I think we sit in a place to say, we want to do something that's better. If it's better for this country, better for taxpayers, better for aviation, why wouldn't we? But until those details become clear, you know, this is all up in the air. As it has been, by the way, as you guys know, for 25 years.
Yeah, yes, yes. But it's interesting, I think, what I'm hearing is that while there may be some aspects of this that a private entity may be more effective or more efficient at operating, and while other aspects of this may be better situated within the government and the regulatory process, it's not an all, or it may not be an all or nothing, a one way or the other way kind of a situation. There may be components that, if you're going to optimize the total, you know, may fall in one direction and other elements may fall in the other. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, I think there's some parts of this thing, you know, that I've heard and sitting on the Next Gen Advisory Committee and through different testimonies, that I think would be frustrating if I was trying to lead the FAA in terms of a stable, predictable funding thing. You know, startups and stops aren't efficient, and maybe a bonding authority needs to be thought about how you can make sure that there's a predictable stream so you can make longer range plans than just one FAA authorization at a time, which I think all of you would recognize is, how can we do that? Well, doesn't necessarily mean privatization. Doesn't mean that we stay status quo. Means that we take a look at what are the problems. And that's probably one that I agree with, that I think we could do better if we're thinking longer term.
Interesting.
At some point, do you think you might end up surveying members just to get their thinking and guidance on how they feel about this?
Oh, we have. And we will continue to do that. And as you know, I do these town halls and we've done these fly-ins and we get a lot of member input. And one of the things I would say is that we hope to be educating our members and our members educating us about what's important and priorities. And one of the reasons why I made basic med our number one issue when I came aboard nearly 4 years ago. And now we have a positive solution, I think, for most members around that. So we work for the members. We work for the future of aviation. There's a reason why we exist. And being a steward of that is really important to me.
In basic med, is it clear sailing? All, you know, everything go for implementing basic med?
It sure feels that way. We've had really good meetings with the FAA in the last couple of weeks to finalize the online course, to finalize the form and the form numbers, the protocols, which will be in place by May 1, all appear at this point in time to be solidly go. And I'm going to give a plug for the FAA on this one. They've been really good to work with once Congress and the President signed for it last year. They have been on or ahead of time, and very cooperative to do what is now law. and it's helped save millions, and I do mean millions of dollars for members and the FAA that does the right thing and still protects safety. So this has been one of those things that seems to me, while not perfect, is darn good, and I think there's 99% of people that are winners on this one.
Our last episode, we heard from the president of AOPA France, who was at Heli Expo, and he made some comments about taking some of the aspects of basic med here in the United States and seeing if that could be applied to other regions of the world, which I thought was very interesting. I hadn't really thought of, you know, extending the concept to other areas.
Yeah, we had an international conference in July last year in Chicago, and I think there were at least 40 of the 80 countries represented, and they all had very much an interest in how do they continue to manage costs in aviation that don't, you know, risk safety, which we've now been able to prove to the FAA and Congress. And, you know, we have applied more recently for representation in Canada, Bahama, and Mexico to recognize this basic med as a traveling document, which the Bahamas have already responded. They're going to work through it with us, hopefully. Canada and Mexico have not responded yet, but we will be working with them to make sure our U.S. travelers can use it, that privilege around the neighboring countries.
Hmm. So we've talked about ATC privatization and fees and touched on basic med. Are there other areas, other advocacy areas that you have on the radar screen for, let's say, this year?
We do. We have, we've worked with the drone membership. We're making sure that we can work together. I also sit on the Federal Advisory Drone Advisory Committee. We've got to figure out how to safely integrate drones into the airspace. And a very important piece, we'd also like to invite drone membership as a separate level so that they can understand how general aviation works and how we can work together to access the airspace. It's very early stages, but pretty darn interesting. We'll be also working in oversight and taking a look at some of this FBO consolidation and what is that meant to cost and pricing and ramp fees that we think maybe need to be challenged in some locations, not all, very few locations, less than a couple hundred, but some places that are seemingly getting to be very expensive to fly in and out of. And we've got some strong views about what needs to be done there. We're in a good place here with aviation safety. I mean, we're always an advocate for how do we become safer, but, you know, we have seen over 2.5 million views this last 12 months on people taking their own time to go access our safety information, which is a lot of this repository of all safety aviation out there. But to see 2.5 million times people have clicked on to go see this, it's actually pretty interesting. And we've just come through the safest year in general aviation's history. We've got more to do, but if the NTSB was really concerned about what's going on, they'd be working on the 35,000 people on the highway than a few hundred that unfortunately pass in an aircraft accident. So we know we've got to constantly work with the general public to understand that general aviation can be as safe as you want it to be, and it's much safer than the news at 11 would have you believe.
Yeah, that's my wife watches the news at 11, and anytime there's a GA aircraft accident, which, I mean, let's face it, they happen fairly frequently, maybe not on a percentage basis, you know, when you look at the number of flights and all, but still, she sees these and looks at me and said, you know, I don't want you up there doing that. It's kind of a perception problem maybe amongst the general public.
You know, since you have such a great audience that are real true aviators, I always like to have the elevator speech ready and say, you know, we want to be 100% safe, and someday maybe possibly that could be done. But let's, if you're going to start to work where the real problems are, you know, 35,000 people on the highways, that killed a year, unfortunately. You know, let's drop down to motorcycles at over 3,000. You know, over 1,000 in boats, and 10,000 people at home falling off ladders and getting electrocuted. We don't call it a funny number, but a real number is they believe over 800 people fall out of bed, hit their heads and die. And general aviation is now down to 400, which is still too many. But if you're really working on where the problems are in terms of mass unfortunate incidents, you know, aviation has fallen pretty low. But we do get the headlines, and you don't see the motorcycle crashes every night. And we're not making that an excuse that that's okay because there's more, because we want to be, that's why we invest so much in our safety programs. We want to be 100% but it just doesn't line up with the facts in terms of where the real risks are.
Right, right. Mark, you mentioned the fly-ins, the regional fly-ins. I wanted to touch on those. For those who may not be aware, AOPA, I guess maybe what forever, had an annual event. And I think this was under your leadership, wasn't it, Mark, that was changed to instead conduct a series of regional fly-ins. And can you talk about that a little bit in terms of, well, first of all, did you think that was going to be a big risk, you know, in changing that model at the beginning? And now that we're 3-4 years into the regional fly-ins, how would you describe their success?
Well, I give credit where credit is due. I was about 3 weeks into the role when Katie Pribble said to me that we have to sign up for the next year's annual summit or expo. And, you know, you got to put several hundred thousand dollars down, lock in. And I went, oof. She had an idea. It was primarily her idea to break these into regional fly-ins where we could access members that just don't have the time or willing to spend the money to go for something that's 3 to 5 days long, different parts of the country. And so decided not to sign the contract, and we set up a course to go the first year in 2014, do 6 of these fly-ins. And, you know, we expected, our pro forma was, well, we'd have 500 or 600 people show up, maybe 100, 125 airplanes, something like that. Well, the very first one, there was a foggy, low, rainy day down in San Marcos, Texas, and about 3,500 people showed up, about 300 oh, airplanes. Wow. And we thought, well, maybe we're onto something. So as it's continued on for the last several years, we've seen over 40,000 people on over 6,000 aircraft. And they're convinced it's a way for our members to access our leadership. It's a way for us to access in a fun, very low cost, regional way. About 75% of these people had never been to an expo or summit because you know, just too far away. And it has been a fun, fun time for us to reconnect with the grassroots of our real humble beginnings in Wings Field, Philadelphia, where it was just about local folks trying to get together and preserve and protect aviation.
Yeah, I actually attended the summit that was in Hartford, which is actually where I met Max Trescott face-to-face for the first time.
That was probably 2012, I think.
Do you remember that?
I do. Yeah, yep. Yeah. It was a very rainy day that summit as well.
That's right. And I had a wonderful time. We actually recorded, Mark, a lot of interviews with attendees as well as some of the people speaking and displaying their products and services at the show. It was great. And so at the beginning, I thought that, well, with these fly-ins, you know, they'd be a lot smaller, maybe not not quite the same type of experience. But one thing that I did sort of latch onto was this notion, as I recall it, that part of the objective would be this ability to reconnect or to connect with the membership, the flyers, the pilots, and so forth, closer to where they live and more of them because it's easier to get to. So is that part of this really been as successful as it seems like it could have been?
More than we could have possibly imagined. And one of the, you know, kind of charters of this thing that we took on is that we wanted to continue to move it, not make it simple for us as AOPA, but keep it moving around the country so that we, you know, put circles every 250 miles where we eventually see basically have the opportunity to see everybody that lives within those 250 miles. And this year where we have Camarillo on April 28th and 9th and Norman, Oklahoma, September 8th and 9th, Groton, Connecticut, so you can make that one, October 6th and 7th, and Tampa, Peter O'Knight, October 27th and 28th, is to never try and go back to the same spot, you know, around our fifth year, fourth year of this. And we actually do survey our members and 97% of them said they would come back if it were held in their area. And the other 3% said maybe. So it's just, you know, really, really fun. And the supplier, vendor, sponsor community, we sell out every one of our booths every time because they want to be there. And what they find is that this is the most enthusiastic, called mine or knowledgeable flyer group, rather than just a bigger, maybe bigger show that we have with more general public feel. These are really dedicated flyers that are there for either safety seminars or update on what's going on in government affairs or whatever. And it's really fun to be there. I really encourage you to come out, and anybody that hasn't been to one, you got to do it just once.
You know, Mark, I really don't recall. Do you have to be an AOPA member to attend?
We don't check anybody's cards at all. We sure encourage it, of course, but the general public's invited. And, you know, that's what we've actually added this year, is a little bit more of a Friday aspect of it, where whether it's a safety seminar or a mechanical seminar, seminars on Friday, that you do have to pay a small amount to be attending these seminars on Friday, because we figured out we just couldn't get all the seminars we wanted in on Saturday in a town hall and all those things. So we've expanded the venue a little bit this year. We still have a barnstormer party where you do pay for your dinner on Friday night, but it's, you know, with a band and a lot of fun. And one of the rules that we've changed in this adventure is we added that any airport that was going to bid on this had to have camping area for people who camp under their airplanes. And we have several hundred campers now at every one of these events.
Wow. So I guess maybe the bottom line is, for those of you listening who have not yet become convinced to join AOPA, that likely there's a fly-in, a regional fly-in near you, and this might be a great way for you to go and, you know, see what AOPA is all about. I'm sure after doing that, you'll want to join and support the organization. Maybe shifting a little bit, Mark, Santa Monica, we've talked about that over the months and as things have developed with respect to that. Can you comment maybe on why this might be something that should be of broader concern than just to the folks in that area?
Well, Alyssa, what a national treasure Santa Monica has been, I hope will continue to be. We now have a stay of the death sentence for 12 years. And that gives an opportunity, I think, for all the aviators to gather around there and reelect officials that understand the value of bringing general aviation there, disaster relief to community access to, frankly, you know, best use of that space. You know, my cynical view of Santa Monica is this has always been about Culver City and West LA, which are just, if you know the geography, just to the west of the airport, and their inability to have 30, 40-story buildings that can see the ocean with a high value of real estate, not the city of Santa Monica residents who largely live west of the airport. As you know, south of the airport is refineries and other things. It's been a really frustrating game because we're playing against that kind of billions and billions of dollars of the real estate value if you could build high buildings in the safety zone. That said, you know, NBA and AOPA for all the years, more than 50, have spent money legally trying to find a way to push this thing back. And while it's, by the way, a very imperfect, and we've challenged it, settlement that the FAA has made with the city. It makes the city mad, by the way, because they didn't get what they wanted. It makes us mad because we don't really think you should have to shrink an airport to 3,500 feet. Yet, if I were a resident with a piston airplane or even a small turboprop, 3,500 feet is a good long length of runway to be able to use for the next dozen years while you work on your energy to figure out how to reelect the right people over the dozen years. So imperfect as it is, and it is very imperfect, and yet it doesn't really set the same precedence as many other airports because there are two parcels underneath that airstrip. One was conveyed as part of the settlement after World War II, and another was a separate really piece of property that had more challenges, if you will, to who actually had the rights to that property, and it did not have, from anything we could legally contest, the perpetuity agreement that the other piece did.
So, Max T, what do you think is going to happen there with Santa Monica?
Oh, boy.
What do you think?
Yeah, I have no idea. I just, you know, I'm hopeful that the local Pilots Association will, you know, do everything they can possibly to, you know, encourage the locals to come out and visit the airport and see what a wonderful resource it is. I don't know. I'm hopeful, but who knows what's going
to
happen.
They were trying to stop the city from being able to immediately chop up the runway while this still plays through the courts. And that is still the case right now, isn't it? I mean, they can still do that?
So what I believe is going on right now, having spent some time with the administrator, Michael Werda, about this just a few weeks ago, you know, our strong recommendation was they don't need to tear up any runway. They just paint it off and make a display threshold. If that's what's going to happen, and make it even a safer airport at 3,500 feet because of the painting. And yes, it'd be a violation if you exceed your takeoff and your runway terms. it clearly creates a much safer environment, and it's, by the way, it's less expensive, and it's still a legal 3,500-foot runway. So we've asked the FAA, who has the final sign-off, and the timelines it takes to resize the airport while some of the legal stuff is going on. But I still think it's months and months and months out before that settlement is done.
All right. Well, we'll be watching that. One other item, Mark. I run across this notion that the U.S. House and Senate General Aviation Caucuses get relaunched with the new administration. Is that right? Tell us about these General Aviation Caucuses, what they mean, what they do, and how they're important.
So, you know, you have to think about it every 2 years because the House coming up for election, some senators, every 2 years, we have to always relaunch an initiative to add to the GA caucus as some leave their seat and some gain their seat. So we're always about that. But right at the moment, in the House, we have 253 members of the General Aviation Caucus and 33 members of the Senate. So very significant what I call listening that we can get accomplished within the House and the Senate because they care about general aviation. And some members of the House or the Senate never join any caucus. The General Aviation Caucus is one of the largest of any caucuses in D.C. So it means we have a listening post that if we say, hey, we need to talk to you about a particular issue, whether it's, you know, user fees or third class medical, we want your attention. It means we can get in to see any of these people pretty much any time. And many times they're leaders in within different committees and partners that want to help us perpetuate aviation and grow it. So it's a very unique circumstance that we have that large of a listening group.
Well, Mark, if our listeners who are not members or who want to learn more about AOPA, probably the best place to go is to the website, right? AOPA.org. Any other resources that you would point people to?
Yeah, AOPA's website is very complete. Everything from your flight planning, weather forecasting, ways to help you enjoy flying through, different getaway places you could go to and interesting spots. And we think the membership is so proud of being an AOPA member and knowing that it makes a difference to be stronger together. And if you talk to your fellow aviators, you know, a very, very significant chunk of the aviators today are an AOPA member. Now, our role is how do we grow aviation? And that's what we're talking about in the future here is you can fly, you know, with embedding STEM education in high school levels for aviation. How do we make the flight training experience even better? You know, how do we grow and bring rusty pilots back, you know, which our rusty pilot forums have been unbelievably successful. We got in the last year or so, 3,500 folks back in the air. Now with basic med, we think there'll be tens of thousands that may return to aviation in a big shot in the arm. And then keep them into aviation with our flying clubs. On our website, you'll find 800 flying clubs as part of our network. And we formed 25 new ones last year. We hope to form 30 new ones this year that ways to lower the cost of flying, way to keep people engaged out at the airport, and just have a lot of darn fun for a low cost of money.
I want to take just a quick PBS-type role here. Mark, this is your opportunity. Tell us a little bit about the magazines, the 800 numbers, the Air Safety Institute, you know, so people really understand the full breadth of benefits they get from joining AOPA.
Hey, thanks for that. For all the years I've been flying since 1977, my instructor said, hey, you got to sign up for AOPA before I'll sign up for solo. I thought it was a son of a gun. But I didn't realize all the benefits that you got, which is, as you know, I consider the best aviation magazine, but it's by far the biggest and most circulated aviation magazine and has been for a long, long time, which is a lot of about, you know, continuing your safety education. And we have a legal advisory program where you can sign up for pilot protection, which includes medical advice as well as legal advice. It's just above the membership. We have insurance agency through our membership that you can access really low-cost insurance, high service. We have aviation finance to help you finance your aircraft. We, again, have the ability to help you form a flying club. And the online AOPA Live, many of these things free. One of the things that we believe in at AOPA is that we want aviators to be safe and knowledgeable and have access to information. Whether you choose to be a member or not, we think it's a great value. But having pilot protection services available to finding a great insurance quote, just a lot of value in being an AOPA member, and most importantly, the pride in being part of the aviation community. So I thank all of our current members, and invite all of our future members to join that great fraternity.
I'm going to ask Rob. Rob, what's your favorite part of EOPA? What do you use the most?
I think when I look back over the years, I'll bet I have called that 800 number with a question more times than I can even count. I think the thing that's really nice is that every time I call, the people are always friendly that answer the phone, even though they know it's me. And I think that it's just great that no matter what the question is, they go, I don't know the answer. Hang on a minute. Let me get somebody else. And there's always somebody there that can answer that kind of maybe sometimes out in left field kind of question.
That's pretty funny. I didn't know what you're going to answer, but that would have been my answer as well, too. I call that Pilot Information Center a number of times a year, so much so that I know the 800 number, and I'm afraid they're starting to know me. last time they called, they kind of went, oh, yeah, we know who you are.
Yeah, I know. Well, actually, see, I've been telling them that I'm you, and that might have had something to do with it, maybe.
That explains it.
Yeah.
All right. All right, Mark Baker, thank you so much for joining us.
Glad to be here, guys, and enjoy your flying.
The first news item comes from, well, this is the International Ops Bulletin that's published by the Flight Service Bureau. Entitled is En route A380 Wake Flips Challenger 604 Upside Down. Well, apparently an Emirates Airbus A380-800 was at flight level 350 over the Arabian Sea, and a Challenger 604 business jet passed 1,000 feet underneath it in the opposite direction. I guess the A380 never knew that anything had happened and continued on to its destination, but the Challenger didn't do so well. Wake turbulence from the A380 put the Challenger into an uncontrolled roll. The aircraft turned around a number of times. Both engines flamed out, reportedly, and the Challenger lost about 10,000 feet of altitude. I guess my question for you, Rob, and Max T might be, don't we have standards for separation that are designed to prevent this sort of problem from occurring?
Well, they're supposed to be. I mean, at that altitude, airplanes are separated by 1,000 feet vertically. And as we were talking before we started tonight, one of the problems we face is that navigation is so good these days that everybody is exactly on the center line almost all the time, where that didn't used to be the case. That being said, if it were me at that altitude, I'm sorry, I wouldn't have flown right under an A380 1,000 feet above me. I would have gone off to one side. If I'm assuming that ATC told the guys in the Challenger that there was an Airbus coming the other way. Now, maybe they didn't, and maybe they had no chance to prepare for that. But, you know, those are details that we're still going to hear about.
What's really amazing to me is that the damage to the Challenger was sufficient that they had to write that aircraft off. I mean, that's pretty amazing that the aircraft was overstressed that much that it couldn't be used again. So this was definitely a full-blown emergency. Now, Rob, here's where I differ from you. See, I actually have flown right under an A380. We had two of them land in Oakland a few months ago because they couldn't land at San Francisco because the winds didn't allow them to land on their favorite runway. And one passed over me about 2,000 feet. And I really thought long and hard about it and thought, okay, 2,000 feet shouldn't be a problem. But I went and looked to find the latest AC recently from the FAA. And I was surprised to find I had always been teaching people that wake turbulence could descend as much as 1,000 feet. But this AC has been revised and it says that it can wake turbulence can actually drop more than 1,000 feet, especially for heavies and super heavies like the A380. So I guess this probably wasn't a big deal before the days of RVSM when they cut the spacing and the flight levels from 2,000 feet to 1,000 feet. So yeah, this is a big deal now.
Next up, we have an article from the Charlotte Observer. This is American Airlines flight attendants sue, say they've been called sows, prostitutes, and worse on Facebook. This is kind of incredible. Two flight attendants claiming sexual and gender harassment on social media have filed federal lawsuits against American Airlines. Now, not because American Airlines was engaged in such practices, but because American Airlines failed to enforce its policies that govern employee use of social media. Apparently, these kinds of harassing statements were made, posted, whatever, online in social media. American policy forbids behavior such as that, even on personal accounts. The two flight attendants say that American Airlines was informed that this was happening, but that the company didn't do anything to enforce their own policies. This is American says that I think that they're going to defend themselves against this. I'm not sure what the basis would be for that if, in fact, they did nothing to try to correct this situation. I don't know. Max T., what do you think about this?
Yeah, you know, this story caught my attention initially. I kind of saw the headline and thought, oh, passengers, you know, taking it out on flight attendants again. And if that had been the story, probably it wouldn't have made it. But what really was the interesting twist on this was it was fellow employees who were treating other employees this way through social media. Now, you and I both used to work for really large corporations. If this ever happened, you know, inside the corporation, you know, people would be fired and gone, you know, immediately. Yeah. Social media has kind of brought a new outlet where I guess some employees at some companies must feel that that's outside the workplace and that's fair game. Well, it's still considered by company policies as, you know, as being a very poor behavior, which, you know, they don't condone. So in this particular case, however, it sounds like American Airlines Human Resources was apprised of this, but didn't do anything to stop it. And if that were true, then, you know, this is going to certainly be you know, going to get litigated in court. So anyway, I think the key thing here is, boy, we got to be nice to our fellow employees, even if we don't agree with them.
Well, you wouldn't think that you'd have to say that, but I guess in this day and age, we still do. And of course, this is very similar to the case that the U.S. Marines are going through right now, where female Marines had pictures of them posted in rather compromising positions. I don't know how they got them, obviously, but the point is that guys were posting them on online on Facebook and some other places, and the ladies involved, I was listening to an interview with one of them the other night, said, look, you know, we didn't just sit back and take it. We went to the legal, I can't remember what the term is, the NCIS, I think, is the legal group for the Marines, but and we told them, and we told them more than once, and they did absolutely nothing. And that's the worst thing, I think, is that not that they didn't handle it very well, but that they don't even respond to these people.
Yeah. The other interesting aspect on this was all union related. So the first flight attendant was harassed after she dropped out of a union position, and the other person was harassed after she announced that she was going to run for a union position. So I guess feelings run deep about union issues. So, boy, just an amazing story.
Yeah, and to people who might say this is their personal accounts, and so how can their employer have anything to say about what they post personally? But look at the result of this. The result is that American Airlines is impacted by the actions, the alleged actions, let's say, of some of their employees. Not all of their employees, obviously, or the company as a whole, but it reflects badly on the company. And that's why oftentimes large companies, anyway, will have these kinds of policies that employees need to first place understand, second place adhere to, but in, you know, third, the company needs to enforce them. So we'll see how this one develops. I think this is you know, a serious matter. I mean, it's like, you know, cyberbullying and that kind of thing. The company has an obligation to its employees and to the public as well. At least that's my opinion. One last news item. This came from our friend Launchpad Marzari. Launchpad says that Boeing just released their annual report, and we'll put a link to that in the show notes if you'd like to read that. On page 125, he says, there's an interesting statement, which is, quote, although C-17 production has completed, one C-17 remains to be sold. Now, Launchpad says, I don't remember seeing this in Trade-A-Plane. If they are stuck with one of last year's model unsold on their lot, maybe they are ready to deal. He says, I wonder if he'll bring it to AirVenture with a for sale banner on it. Anyone in for partnership or fractional ownership of the Airplane Geeks charter airlines? I think that's pretty funny. Thanks, Launchpad, for sending that in for inclusion in the news. I don't know, you guys have any idea what we might do with a C-17?
I put it online with a local flying club, but I'm trying to figure, would we rent it dry or wet?
Yeah. Oh, I think you'd have to do it dry because the gas would be a little exorbitant, but... You know, mentioning Mr. Launchpad, did he tell you about his adventures down at HAI where they hoisted him up into the Coast Guard helicopter on the virtual reality game that we went to see?
Yeah, so he was wearing a VR headset, I think, right?
Correct.
And those watching this happen could see around him the scene, kind of a recovery operation at sea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we could see what he saw in his glasses, and so it was pretty neat because he said he felt just like he was there, and some guy tried to capture it on video. During the event, and I don't know, I don't think he did a very good job because Launchpad didn't use the video, I think. I can't remember who the cameraman was, but he seemed a little upset that it wasn't quite up to his standards. But I tried, too. I really did. I thought I was doing such a good job holding my iPhone steady while he's going up and down in this crazy contraption, and then
it was all good, Rob, until you turned the iPhone 90 degrees to try to get it horizontal, and video doesn't work that way on the phone.
So
you have to sort of turn your head 90 degrees in order to be able to watch it after you turn the or after that particular videographer turned the phone 90 degrees.
Yes, we did agree that we weren't going to mention his name. Obviously, I've completely forgotten the incident anyway. So, but no, actually, it was really nice. We had a chance to walk the show and see an awful lot of things, and he was really into wearing his Airplane Geeks badge everywhere, and he did find some really interesting stories. So I hope he was able to share some of that with
you. Yes, he did that last episode. Speaking of video, Mark, AOPA has a really nice video news podcast that comes out weekly. Are you guys all as excited about that production as we are on this end?
Well, I hope you're excited as we are, put it that way. AOPA Live is led by Tom Hain and Melissa Rudinger. I think, you know, it's the best 20 minutes you can spend weekly, you know, getting the visuals, what's happened, you know, where the organization's headed, what we're seeing. And I think they do a darn good job at pulling it off every week.
They really do. And it's very professionally done, too. The good high production values. This isn't, you know, your guy with an iPhone who doesn't know horizontal versus video vertical, you know, it's some helicopter show.
Yeah, that's right. And I think, you know, even the last week where we had Sean receiving the Hoover Award, and it was just it's an uplifting experience, but then we can share with a lot of people that can't be there.
Yes, yes. And you can find that on iTunes or I don't know, if you're in the Google Play Store, probably. And you can find that also on any of the major podcast apps.
That's right. Facebook as well.
And on Facebook as well. So, in fact, we'll put a link to that in the show notes. But, yeah, highly recommended. All right, let's do a little bit of what's up with the geeks real quick. Rob, what's going on in your world?
Well, let's see. This week I'm going to moderate an IMC club event, which is in Chicago.
What's the IMC Club?
Well, Max, it's a good thing that you asked me that. The IMC Club was for instrument-rated pilots or people that want to be, and we kind of get together and talk about a particular case study, essentially, and talk about what you could do, what you shouldn't do, what you can't do, what you might have done, and it's really to get people thinking about the fact that when they are newly rated, especially, or when they haven't flown on instruments in a while, that they can get a little rusty, that their brains need a little fertilization, shall we say. And the IMC Club is really an owned club from it's an owned group from EAA. And there are chapters all over the U.S. and I believe outside the U.S. now as well. And, you know, I think on Wednesday we're going to have about 20 people there, and I'm going to give them a scenario and say, okay, so there you have it. Now, what would you do in this case? And it's amazing because once you tell people that there are no wrong answers, people just start coming up with incredibly insightful ideas on how to handle a situation. And that's what we're really trying to do is to encourage people to think long before they actually need it when they're really in the clouds.
That's a really interesting idea.
Yeah, it's a fun group.
Yeah. All right. Good. And Max West, you've recently had something published.
Oh, I had something come in the mail today. I was delighted to see. I've been a member of AOPA for just about 30 years now, and I think this is the first time I've had anything published in there. So if you, this is one more good reason to go out and join the organization. So on page 20, you'll find a column that I wrote about stabilized approach economics. And basically, pilots are always taught to fly stable approaches, but I don't think they always know exactly what that means. And so I kind of gave them details on folks who've had to either pay with a lot of money or with their lives for failing to fly stabilized approaches. So anyway, it was a fun opportunity. And Mark, thank you very much for printing my article.
It's always good to have it, you know, because the realities of stabilized approaches is it sounds easy, but there's a lot of details that goes into making sure you're not, you know, outside the parameters of a safe stabilized approach.
Yeah, there's no question that a timely go-around can save a lot of embarrassment and money and maybe even your life. So that's what I was talking about. So that was kind of fun. It was great getting that in the mail today.
I always think of it as, a go-around is a sign of success as compared to the alternative.
Yep, exactly. And you know, it's funny, years ago, I used to always kind of back and forth in my mind, should I go around or not? Should I go around or not? Finally, what I heard was the best advice I'd ever heard, which was the moment you start thinking maybe you should go around, that's when you should decide to go around.
Yep, and we still all do it, and it's always okay. I always attaboy people when they do that. It's just fine. More flying. How bad could it be?
Yes. Mark, has AOPA Pilot been published throughout the entire history of the organization?
Well, interesting enough, you know, the organization started in 1939. It was an insert in Flying Magazine right up through early 1960, and then it became its own standalone publication at that point in time.
Wow. Yeah, I didn't know that. It just sort of popped into my head. That question just popped into my head. But there again, you know, like the video news podcast, really high quality stuff. I mean, it's professional. This is not a club newsletter, you know.
No, we get requests from all the world. I'm serious, every week. And it's just so difficult, you know, to honor everything. But fortunately, aviation's universal language is generally English. But we send this magazine all over the world. It goes to basically every country in the world because of the quality. Safety information does transfer. While some of the legal and government issues may not be as transferable skills,
right.
All the other stuff and knowledge about aircraft and maintenance and ways to enjoy flying is a universal language.
Mark, do you know how many issues are printed?
To go overseas?
Just in total.
Over 350,000.
Wow. Amazing. Amazing.
Yeah.
All right. We'll continue here. We have from David his interview from the Restoration Center at the National Air and Space Museum. A few weeks ago, David took a trip down there and got to see and talk to some folks about what they're doing, and we wanted to bring that to you. And so we'll play that right now.
This is David standing in the Mary Baker Egan Restoration Facility. I'm here with Christopher Moore in the Aeronautics Division, and we're going to talk about one of the major projects sitting on the floor here, a B-26 by the name of Flakbait. Christopher, thank you for being on Airplane Geeks.
Thank you, David. Glad to be here.
So, tell me about Flakbait, where we are, and some of the challenges.
Well, Flakbait is 2 years into its restoration. We have several years, probably more to go. Right now, one of the main things we're working on is the control surfaces, and that's been one of our big challenges. The control surfaces are all fabric covered on this aircraft. So over 70 years, the fabric has shrunk. It's split, cracked, and is generally in bad shape. The paint's oxidized, and our conservators have come up with some new techniques, basically working like painting conservators for canvas. And what they've done is cut the fabric off the metal framework. They've put a synthetic covering over that to act as a base and glued the old fabric back over it. And they filled in cracks and generally made it look as close as we can to it as it did in 1945 without losing any of the originality.
Interesting point that you're talking about. Painting conservatory, the fields cross-mingling, you wouldn't normally think of that with an airplane, but that's canvas is canvas, I guess, huh?
Right, yeah, canvas and paint. There's been a lot of consultation with the conservators in the Smithsonian that deal with paintings and their techniques and things. So, yeah, it's been a real eye-opener for all of us, and it's generally a cutting-edge technique for restoration aircraft preservation.
And how about the rest of the airframe?
The rest of the airframe is moving along slowly. They're consolidating paint. We're trying not to lose any more paint than has been lost. They're working on the engines. We found out we were missing some parts for engines, and we're trying to get those parts where they went over the last 70 years. We're not sure, but we had to attain new generators for both engines, and everything's moving along.
And what kind of challenges, like to obtain a new generator? What would you need? What did you need to do that?
Well, our restoration specialists, they have a network and know of people that are flying aircraft. And generally, they'll go to those people, and there's the stuff is out there. It's just trying to know the people who have it, and we've been successful so far.
So when are we going to see a completed fuselage?
Good question. Probably, I would say, fingers crossed, in 2 to 3 years, but don't hold me to that.
And what are the challenges with getting the multiple pieces we see here together into one?
Yeah, that's a good question, too. Each one had its own stand made. Those stands aren't necessarily the same heights, so they're not the same angles or anything, so they weren't made to mate together the fuselage pieces. So our specialists are looking at factory manuals, photographs from the factory, in how these things were actually done. And that'll be a process in the next couple of years, is just making stands so we can actually mate the fuselage pieces.
Things you don't think about when you're restoring an aircraft, having to make the stand so you can restore the aircraft. What, chicken or the egg, huh?
That's right, yeah. Yes.
And we also know that the nose is getting it examined and over time has had historical graffiti, let's call it, on it, as well as some maintenance, because it was on display since the museum opened downtown. So there's some challenges with having it out in the open, and it wasn't locked away like the rest of the parts, right?
Right, that's true. when it was at the air base in Germany, right shortly before it was disassembled, it seems it was quite an attraction, and it was a popular for service members to come up and sign their names on it. Most of them seem to be on the right side for some reason, but we're currently undertaking a project to map those names, to get them in a database. There might be a possibility of trying to locate some of those people at some point. But first, we've got to make sure we have them. Some have been partially rubbed off, and we're using infrared and UV photography. So there's all kinds of cutting-edge things being used on this. The damage, we'll call it, from being downtown, it was easily accessible to visitors, and they like to touch it to see what it feels like, which seems to be a common thing. And unfortunately, they wore away some of the paint on the front and back of the nose. So that's a challenge. We don't like to modify or add anything, but we will have to paint that in with a reversible paint, so just because it's so obvious, and the shiny metal there would really stand out if we didn't do something to blend it in.
It's kind of ironic that Flakbait's history didn't end with Flakbait's history. It was so famous that it's gotten other layers of significance on it over time.
That's correct. Yeah, and starting from the beginning on the nose wheel doors, the disassembly crew painted their names. Now, we would like this to be, you know, as Flakbait Luton Combat, but we're not going to go back and paint, take out some names that were painted in 1945. But the things such as the paint being worn away from the nose are a little easier to say, yeah, we really need to connect that. And there was actually some damage. Not sure exactly what time, but the fuselage pieces were lifted with a sling, and the sling buckled the metal a little bit. So it's possible when they were loading it in Germany or at some other point, and that's a difficult challenge with sheet metal. With you know, fabric, it's easier to repair, but sheet metal, we actually have on one of the Bombay doors had to cut out a piece where it was buckled from the sling and replace that. So it's a delicate balance. We'd like to keep as much as possible, but things that are really obviously wrong with it or damaged, we need to replace or fix.
I can't wait watching this journey. I love coming to, knowing it's back here, I love coming to see what happens next. So, Christopher, thank you for taking your time. Just shows you folks what's involved with restoration at my favorite place on the planet. There's a little bit more than just putting the airplane back together. Christopher, thank you for being on Airplane Geeks.
Thank you.
Yeah, the Restoration Center at the National Air and Space Museum is really an impressive facility. It's always interesting to see the work they do because, as I think we've mentioned before, they don't necessarily restore everything. Many of the exhibits are meant to be in the condition that the aircraft, the spacecraft, or whatever it happens to be, was in. When it entered into the collection. Interesting conversation from David. Appreciate that. David will be joining us again pretty soon, I think, regularly again. We all look forward to that. All right, we have another listener recording. Now, if you've been following us along, you know that we've been encouraging all of you to send in a short recording describing a memorable flight that you've had in the past. And we've had just so many people send in some great recordings and a couple in written form that we really appreciate it. They're all different, all interesting. We have one from Glenn Towler, and he actually has two flights that he's going to tell us about. So let's listen to Glenn.
Hi, Geeks. It's Glenn Towler here from New Zealand. You're asking about most memorable flights, and I had I've got two. One was a flight I was supposed to take from Darwin, Australia, to Sydney, Australia. It was 1 o'clock in the morning. We'd already been delayed by over an hour due to a thunderstorm. The crew weren't allowed to work in a thunderstorm, and they had to load the bags. So there we were. I was sat down the back in economy, of course. We were just taxied down to the runway. Everything seemed quite normal. Power came up, started going down the runway, and then suddenly we stopped really quite quickly. And then the captain came up on the PA. Oh, yes, we've just hit a bird on takeoff. It went straight for the starboard engine. And apparently I was all sat on the port side, so I didn't actually get to see the bird go for the engine, which was quite a shame. It made apparently made a really big, bright flash as it went through and destroyed the engine. So that was the end of that flight. And we taxied back to the terminal. Everyone got back off, of course. We got all our bags. Virgin Australia put us up in a hotel and in the airport itself. And then we tried again a few hours later, and everything just went normal, takeoff. So that was the most quite memorable flight. My other most memorable flight was a flight on a Royal New Zealand Air Force 757. We were flying from a place called Ohakia, which is like in the middle of the North Island, down to Wellington. It was only a 20-minute flight, but I was asked to sit in the jump seat on the flight deck. And, of course, I was like, yes. Oh, yes, please. I did take a few pictures, and it was only a 20-minute hop, but it was pretty memorable, as I was, of course, being in the flight deck of a 75. It always is. You know, the plane, it's a great plane to be a great plane for performance-wise, but not a great plane to be the passenger. Too narrow. But anyway, it's a very memorable flight, and certainly made my day. I mean, it's just so unusual these days to get a flight on the flight in the flight deck, of course, with all the 9/11 stuff, but being a Defence Force employee, you're allowed to sit at the front. I have got photographs I can share with you of the flight deck and my short flight, but it was, yeah, very memorable flight. And anyway, keep up the good work, of course, and hope to see you all at Oshkosh. Glenn out.
All right, thanks, Glenn. Bird strikes. Since I'm a jet engine guy, bird strikes have a certain meaning to me, but what about for general aviation? Mark, are bird strikes a big issue for GA?
Yes, they are. We don't read about them as often, but often they're, you know, I had one myself earlier this spring in outside of Iowa, and just about took the antenna off the top of my bearing. But you know, from a risk to flight, I've had my own airplanes hit. I've hit ducks and make a big old dent, cost you a few thousand bucks to fix. Generally, however, you're not flying at the same speeds as the jets, and the density and the speed are in our favor in light GA. But it's always a risk.
Let's do a quick survey, Rob. How many birds?
Do you mean that I have hit in my life? I can honestly only remember taking one direct hit in the Hawker on takeoff, and we heard a bump and you know, told the tower, and they said they found a dead bird, and you could tell by the blood after we landed. But I've had a couple of close ones, many close ones, but only one direct hit.
Yeah, I've had five. The most recent one was two for the price of one. Gentleman taking off in a guy taking off in a DA-40, and just moments after we rotated, there were some seagulls, and you know, it was one of those situations where if I'd only grabbed the yoke and pulled just a little bit, we would have gone above it. I'm always surprised when pilots kind of see birds coming and they don't react. It's like, you know, it would have been so easy just to kind of pull up a couple of feet and miss him, but he didn't do it. So, oh well.
What happens if a bird hits a propeller? Is it sort of the same kind of situation as with a jet engine?
Yeah, I haven't had a problem. All my strikes have been on other parts of the airplane.
Oh, all right.
My experience with the prop is that they generally mince them up before they actually make contact with the airplane. So it's not been a big issue. I suppose if you hit a goose, it'd be a different.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, basically the same thing for a jet engine. A small bird is just... Yeah, it's not going to affect the engine. It's not so good for the bird, but a large bird like a goose or something, that can be a different matter. Here's a transition. Speaking about propellers, and moving on to just a couple of listener emails that we received, Derek sent one in. Derek is, he says, I'm sure you'll have had this little piece of news from your many Australian followers. This is from the Sydney Morning Herald. Passenger plane's propeller shears off in mid-flight, forcing emergency landing in Sydney. And in this case, it was a Regional Express Saab 340. And it was carrying 16 passengers, three crew. Pilots felt some kind of a vibration, I guess, and they were about to shut down the right-hand engine. But as they looked out the cockpit window, they saw the propeller disappear over the wing. I think it could have been much more tragic if the propeller had hit anything else, I guess, as it departed the airplane. But at this point, we don't know what the cause of this was. I can imagine several different scenarios that might...
They haven't even found the propeller yet. That's the thing I think is most interesting. I mean, it came down in an area southwest of Sydney where it's a town of 80,000. And so far, no one has reported a propeller sticking out of their roof or out of the top of their car or anything like that. Luckily, nobody was hurt on the ground, apparently.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
There's one other aspect of the story. It doesn't show up in this account, but I read elsewhere that apparently these gentlemen who were flying, they had engine difficulty, and it was about 40 minutes out from their destination. They were just passing Canberra Airport, but they elected to continue on, even though the engine apparently was having trouble. So some people are kind of questioning, well, wait a minute, isn't that kind of the primary thing you do is, anytime you've got any type of engine trouble, land as soon as practically. In this case, you really run a great risk that things are going to get worse. And apparently they had engine problems initially, decided not to land at Canberra, and then the prop left later on. So they had an opportunity to save this prop if they'd only landed sooner.
Yeah, I don't know if this is an issue with maintenance, incomplete reassembly or improper reassembly or metal fatigue and a fracture. I mean, there could be lots of causes, I guess, for this kind of a thing to happen. But it definitely seems like one that ought to be able to, through the investigation, be determined pretty precisely.
I think they grounded four of their other five aircraft afterwards, so they may actually suspect that there are some maintenance issues here.
Ah, interesting. All right, one other item, and speaking of interesting, I find this fascinating. This came from Chris, and he said, thought you'd be interested in this video from the BBC website about the idea of using circular runways. That's right, circular runways. He says, would love to hear the team's comments on this idea. So we'll have a link. The video from the BBC is titled, Will Circular Runways Ever Take Off? Okay, cute. But it's exactly what it sounds like. If you can imagine an airport in the center of a ring, and the idea is that planes would land... on this ring that might actually even be banked. You could have maybe three planes landing at once on this kind of a circular runway. The idea is it takes up a lot less space. It's more compact. Other benefits they talk about are, well, it says you could have landing from all different directions, from any direction. You kind of spread the noise around a little bit more. You don't have any crosswind landing problems because you could just, land from whichever direction you don't have a crosswind. I love these kinds of ideas that are completely outside the box, or what would seem to be. What do you guys think? Do you think this is this nuts?
I keep wondering if the architect who came up with this is actually a pilot or not. I could see how theoretically, you could be landing, three aircraft simultaneously. But what kind of patterns are, you're going to have three different landing patterns? It sounds like it's going to be a little confusing in the air to me.
Or 360 different landing patterns, one for each degree.
And what's the downwind for each of these? It just sounds a little odd.
Well, the one that caught me is I was trying to imagine making an instrument approach and breaking out of the clouds at minimums to a round runway, as if you didn't have enough potential vertigo issues when you break out of the clouds, maybe at night as it is. Now you have to cope with a round runway. That I'm not saying it's impossible, but as we said earlier when we were talking about ATC privatization, the devil is in the details. So let's let's model it and see what it looks like.
That part actually makes sense, though. Haven't you ever done Circle to Land?
Oh, jeez. Oh, I should have seen that one coming. Oh, my God.
For our non-instrument rated pilots, that's a procedure.
That's where you know, Max, I think you've been on. You know, we're going to do your quality review here. I think we need to be very honest that your jokes are getting as bad as mine. And uh-oh. And that is not good, I don't think, for either one of us.
Well, if you guys think about it, that idea is a really old idea, in that all the aerodromes in the teens and 20s were circular because they couldn't have any crosswinds, and they didn't care about runway lights or anything like that from an alignment perspective, well before instrument flying. So it's actually a really old idea.
That's interesting. And, you know, I got curious to find out if this is the idea of one individual or where this came from exactly. And it was actually a formal project called the Endless Runway. There's a website for it, endlessrunway-project.eu. It started in 2012, this particular project. They made their final presentation 2 years later in 2014. The BBC has kind of gone back to this sort of old story, if you will, and sort of reinvigorated it a little bit. But if you look at their website, the Endless Runway website, the participants in this little project are, you know, they're not insignificant. There's the National Aerospace Laboratory, NLR, in the Netherlands, also DLR, the German National Research Center for Aeronautics and Space, something called ONERA, the French National Aerospace Research Center, INTA, that's a Spanish research establishment, and ILOT, I-L-O-T, the Polish Institute of Aviation. So there were some folks involved in this that maybe, I don't know, Max, maybe they weren't all pilots. Maybe none of them were pilots, but at least they had some kind of an aviation focus to them, or aerospace.
You know, I think if you look at just the final aspect, the touching down part, I'm sure all that stuff, you know, makes total sense and probably could increase capacity. I'm still just kind of left wondering, how do they feed three or four paths, you know, to this aircraft, to this airport? So who knows?
Well, my position has almost always been that, you know, the crazier the idea, typically, you know, the better the germ that's in there, most creative or something really that innovates in ways that people can't anticipate, you know, just extrapolating what you know. But, you know, if you take the basic idea of, you know, you need a long runway and it's really hard to especially build new long runways, what if you built something much smaller and did it in a circle? So, interesting idea. So we want to thank our listener, Chris, for sending that in. Again, we'll put links to that in the show notes. You can take a look at it. Tell us what you think. You think this is a crazy idea?
The problem with this is, though, is the kind of government that airports have in places. I mean, they would talk and talk and talk about this, but you know they'd never get around to it.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, Max, see, I need to work on them, buddy.
You know, I still wonder about land usage as well. You know, so would this require a lot more pavement, for example? Would the total amount of land, you know, being used be more or less? And how would you implement this at a legacy airport? You know, if you've got an operating airport, how would you convert it to this?
Yeah,
I mean, this really seems like it would work best for a brand new airport being constructed in the, you know, the middle of a field.
You know what, Max? Did you hear what Rob said? He said, "Get around to it." I just got it now.
Oh, my God. I thought you guys just, yeah, never mind. Okay.
I missed
no, but actually,
it.
You know, I had a question. Mark, when you mentioned that this is the way it used to be in the old days, you were referring to the fact that they were usually just big open fields and they could land in any particular direction they wanted to, right?
Well, actually, more formally than that, if you look at some of the early Navy strips, I think they're Navy, that the Stearman guys used to train in, and you can look at a book called, I think it's Carrier on the Prairie, that showed how they always landed into the wind with the old Stearmans in the 30s. And the basic courses, and it was set up as a round aerodrome.
Huh. Mm. Yeah, interesting. There's almost nothing that isn't, you know, hasn't been tried once before. Everything new is old, I guess is another way to say it. All right, well, that's about it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. We want to thank Mark Baker, President and CEO of the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association, AOPA, for joining us this episode as our guest. Again, Mark, thanks so much.
Thank you, guys. Thanks for what you do, and thanks for all the aviators out there that support aviation in any way.
Perfect. All right. You can find us at airplanegeeks.com. Visit the website for the links where you can find us on social media, how to contact us, how to subscribe to the show. If you want to go straight to the show notes for this episode, just visit airplanegeeks.com/444. That's the episode number. Let's tell everybody where they can find us online. Rob, Mark, let's start with you.
Well, they'll find me at any place that has Jetwine in the name of it, or at Flying Magazine. And as I've mentioned in the past, I'm not really in the magazine. It's just the words I've written that are in the magazine.
Okay. All right, Max, how about you?
Oh, the usual places, Facebook, Twitter, just look for Max Trescott, T-R-E-S-C-O-T-T. Or if you're coming out to the Bay Area and want to fly any of the Cirruses out here for rent or anything else, just go to SJ, short for San Jose, sjflight.com.
Great. And you can find me on Twitter at Max Flight. Look for me on LinkedIn. Also with David every Friday except last Friday on the UAVDigest.com. The most recent episode out there is the one where we spoke with Kat from AOPA. She's their new director of UAS, and we had a great conversation with her about AOPA welcoming drone pilots into the organization and why they should be excited about that, and also why manned pilots should be excited about that as well. So check that out. Also, find me on the PaxX podcast with Mary Kirby. Our intro music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. Outro by Bruno Massone. Bruno's an interesting guy. He creates music, but he mixes in aviation sounds with more traditional types of music. So check him out at brunomassone.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Good night, everybody.
Hey, keep the blue side up.
Thanks, King. We'll be right back.